ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning and welcome to AM. It's Friday, the 8th of March. I'm Sally Sara, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. US President Joe Biden is expected to use his State of the Union address later today to announce plans for a temporary port to get more aid into Gaza. The proposal comes as the United Nations and humanitarian groups warn of famine in the besieged territory. North America correspondent Barbara Miller reports.
It's a sign of just how much pressure Joe Biden is under over the Gaza war that his administration officials are briefing the media in advance of his State of the Union address about an emergency initiative to try and help alleviate the suffering there. Officials say the US military will be involved in the establishment of a temporary port and pier on the Gaza coast to allow in shipments of aid. At the same time, Joe Biden is likely to nod to the pain of the families of hostages taken from Israel in the October 7 attacks. And the war in Gaza is just one of many issues the president will seek to navigate tonight.
It's not supposed to be a campaign speech, but everything the president does during an election year, and by the way, everything you're going to hear from the jeers that might come out of the crowd, are of course election-oriented.
Todd Belt, professor at George Washington University in D.C., says the president needs to sell his achievements in office so far and prove that he's not too old for a second term.
The big risk tonight is everybody is watching for that gotcha moment, that they're going to find something where he slips up or mispronounces something or gets something wrong. So if there's any sort of gaffe or if there's any sort of zinger or something that goes really well, those are the types of things that get repeated, and that has a lasting impact.
The First Lady's guests always give clues as to some of the key themes of the State of the Union. And it's no surprise that women with personal experience of having IVF or abortions denied to them in the wake of the overturning of Roe v. Wade are on the list. Members of Congress can also bring guests, and Republican Thomas Massey has invited Julian Assange's brother, Gabriel Shipton.
Looking at always trying to find ways to get more attention on his situation, but really, I think to remind Joe Biden that there is a family in this as well, and a family that has been torn apart, and hopefully seek some compassion from the president.
Realistically, though, you know, do you think you're on his radar in any way?
Even if he doesn't see me there or, you know, doesn't acknowledge my presence or anything like that, I think they'll be getting the message that I'm here as Thomas Massey's guest.
The presidential election is still 8 months away, but there's a lot at stake tonight for Joe Biden, who must be conscious that if things don't go his way, it could be his last State of the Union. This is Barbara Miller on Capitol Hill reporting for AM.
As some Palestinians in Gaza face starvation, some Israeli protesters are repeatedly trying to stop aid from getting into the Palestinian territory. The protesters say blocking humanitarian supplies could force Hamas to release the estimated 100 Israelis still being held hostage by the group in Gaza. Eric Torchek reports from the Israel-Egypt border.
Israeli police try to move activists who are blocking a truck crossing with Egypt. Officers grab a woman who's refusing to leave the road. This group says no food should go into Gaza while Hamas holds Israelis hostage.
We don't want to give food to people who murdered our people, who take them chatufim 151 days. You understand that? The women are being abused, they got no food. And we give food to Hamas!
The police effort to move protesters is quickly abandoned and they're allowed to stay. A teenage girl is briefly detained and called a heroine when she's released. This is the Nitzana crossing, some distance from Gaza. It's where trucks come for inspection by the Israelis before driving along a secured military road to Gaza. Trucks are lined up on the Egyptian side, but the Israeli crossing remains closed while the protesters are there, playing guitar and backgammon and sharing snacks. Ah, This group includes Yael Savarigo, who survived the October 7 attacks and whose uncle was taken hostage. My daughter didn't drink for 14 hours, she says. A one-year-old girl, 14 hours, she didn't get water. Didn't get water because Hamas decided to attack the State of Israel. The group has been blocking this crossing and the one into Gaza multiple times a week since January. The United Nations estimates 576,000 Palestinians in Gaza are at catastrophic levels of deprivation and starvation. But these activists say that's the price Gazans must pay for the October 7 terrorist attacks.
None of the people of Gaza, no one is innocent.
But not everybody agrees. There was a counter-protest at the Gaza crossing with a different group demanding more food be allowed in.
We have a truck full of food for the people starving in Gaza. The police and the army won't let us get in.
The Israeli government says it's not imposing any restrictions on aid. Spokesman Ilon Levy blamed poor UN distribution for the shortages inside Gaza.
There are no limits, no limits on the amount of humanitarian aid that can enter the Gaza Strip.
The same day as the protest, Israel says 225 trucks did go into Gaza via a different crossing. But the World Food Programme says its first attempt to deliver food to northern Gaza in weeks was blocked by the Israeli military. And at this crossing, it wasn't soldiers with guns blocking the trucks, but families with flags. This is Eric Twarczyk reporting from the Egypt-Israeli border for AM.
It's one of the enduring mysteries of modern aviation. And 10 years after the disappearance of Malaysia Airlines flight MH370, some families are still seeking answers. On this day, a decade ago, the flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing, with 239 people on board, vanished from radar screens and crashed, presumably, into the Indian Ocean. Seven of the victims were Australian. As Southeast Asia correspondent Bill Birtles reports, many relatives want the search to resume.
In Kuala Lumpur this week, a sombre gathering in a shopping mall as some family members marked the anniversary. But this was no ordinary memorial. There were speeches about technical aspects of searching the sea floor, discussions of funding and talk of compensation. K.S. Narendra's wife was on the flight 10 years ago.
While we, the families, may have reached a settlement with our emotions, our search for answers hasn't ended. While questions linger, there can never be a comprehensive closure.
Like many speakers, he hopes the deep ocean search by a private company that was abandoned in 2018 can be restarted.
We also know that technological advances made can offer a speedier and more precise search outcome. So why isn't the government eager? What credible reasons might there be?
He's hopeful that Malaysia's government will commission US company Ocean Infinity to resume the search. Malaysia's Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim, visiting Melbourne earlier this week, said his government is open to resuming the search if compelling new evidence can be presented. The government has invited the American company for talks soon. Oceanography specialist Charita Patiarachi from the University of Western Australia says resuming the search is worthwhile.
The technology has increased tremendously. They're going to use remotely controlled surface vehicles, which are deploying autonomous underwater vehicles. That's never been done before. So that's the technological advance, that you don't actually have people in very rough weather.
He says the sonar technology would detect large items like the wheels or engines, but stresses the proposal to resume searching still will cover an area the size of Tasmania. And there's no guarantee the flight recorder, known as the black box, could be found or still be intact after sitting beneath the sea for 10 years. Speaking in Kuala Lumpur this week, VPR Nathan, who lost his wife on board MH370, said he hopes Malaysia's government is willing to take the chance on a new search, even despite the potential cost.
Well, of course it can be found. It's a matter of time. You know, there have been ships lost that are found after hundreds of years. So we cannot say that this plane will never be found.
That's VPR Nathan, the husband of an MH370 passenger, ending Bill Birtle's report. You're listening to AM, where it's 19 minutes past seven. And coming up on RN Breakfast on this International Women's Day, Patricia Karvelas will speak to Dr. Natalia Cannon, the Executive Director of the United Nations Population Fund. A new report has found that 45% of women and girls turning to homelessness services after fleeing violent situations. And in the past year, the number of women and children sleeping rough or in a car after accessing homelessness support rose by 23%. The problem is worsened by the fact that perpetrators of family and domestic violence are also often controlling finances, making it difficult for a safe escape plan. Isabel Masali reports.
Right now, across the country, support services for women escaping family violence share the same story.
The demand is absolutely outrageous. We've never seen anything like it, and it's only getting worse.
Perth woman Rach Mack is a domestic violence survivor, now helping others to escape their perpetrators. While the crisis accommodation she runs is at capacity, her team tries to find other options. It's a tough task in a tight rental market. And she says the problem means women are returning to unsafe homes when they have nowhere to go or not leaving in the first place.
This is why I believe deaths and incidents due to DV are escalating, because these women and children have nowhere to go. And then once you leave, if you leave to go in your car, you're then deemed homeless and run the real threat of child protection removing children from your care.
New analysis today shows domestic and family violence continues to be a leading cause of homelessness for Australian women, and it's getting worse. The report examined data from the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare and was compiled by advocacy group Homelessness Australia. Kate Colvin is the CEO.
The number of women and children who are fleeing violence and becoming homeless has significantly increased. So it's increased 23% just in the past year, and it's doubled in a decade. And what we know is that the housing crisis is a big cause of this, because women simply can't find a home that they can afford. And so because we've got record low vacancy rates and rents just keep coming up, we do unfortunately expect this problem is just getting worse and more women will end up on the street after fleeing a violent home.
Kate Colvin is also worried some women and children leave these situations only to return after experiencing homelessness. She's calling on the federal government to take action.
The enormous opportunity that we have is that the government will soon release a national housing and homelessness plan, and that gives them the opportunity for bold ambition to fix this problem. And the kinds of strategies that are needed to fix the problem is investment in low-cost rental housing, is investment in homelessness services so that there's a worker there to help people access housing and to provide the accommodation resources that are needed.
In a statement, the Housing and Homelessness Minister, Julie Collins, said work continues on the Housing and Homelessness Plan and stressed all governments are committed to ending violence against women and children and ensuring they have a safe place to go. She added significant investments have been made. Among them is the Housing Australia Future Fund that will build 4,000 homes for women and children fleeing family violence and older women on low incomes who are at risk of homelessness.
That's Isabel Masali reporting. And if you're in an abusive situation or you know someone who is, you can call 1-800-RESPECT. That's 1-800-737-732. If it's an emergency, you can call 000. A scam targeting Australian customers of one of the world's biggest banks is on the rise. The ABC can reveal that more than $6 million has been stolen from HSBC customers in an impersonation scam, making it the bank with the highest losses in the sector in 2023. And now some of those customers say regulators and the bank are not doing enough to stop the swindle. The specialist reporting team's Emily Lawrence has the story.
You'd be forgiven for thinking this is a real HSBC employee.
We haven't allowed these transactions to leave your account.
But it's a scammer in action, recorded by a victim who doesn't want to be named. The scammer even pretends to book a fraud analyst.
I'm just going to look into getting an appointment made for you to go into branch.
There was no appointment, only a hole in the customer's savings of almost $50,000. The HSBC customer called a phone number, texted from a legitimate HSBC bank message thread, alerting them to a fake fraud, and parted with some personal details, giving scammers access to their account.
They gain full access into my mobile banking.
That's Melbourne woman, Mary Yu. The same thing happened to her.
And so they obviously removed my device and added their own device into it and changed the daily limits and extracted money.
Mary Yu is now one of 40 people who've teamed up in an HSBC victim support group, which hopes to put an end to the scam. None of them have been reimbursed. Sunny Wan leads the group.
Every time someone reaches out to me, I'm like, oh my God, another one. We want answers from HSBC.
The ACCC's revealed reported customer losses in the HSBC scam have reached $6.3 million since July last year. More than 420 reports were made to ScamWatch in 2023. HSBC declined an interview with the ABC. The international bank said it doesn't ask customers for account details over the phone and gives warnings about spoofing messages. There is an alert from the watchdog to HSBC customers and general warnings like this.
So whenever you receive a call, email or text that asks for sensitive information or money, stop. Not everyone is who they say they are. Who's really there?
But victims want to know who is standing between them and criminals. Consumer Action Law Centre CEO Stephanie Tonkin says HSBC has to do far more to protect customers.
I would like HSBC to fortify its systems.
She's calling for a crackdown on whatever telco is allowing the dodgy messages to get through.
So that is a very weak spot. Someone needs to look into what can be done to stop them.
The ACCC says banks need mandatory codes on protecting customers. Meanwhile, the federal government's planning to introduce an SMS sender ID registry to prevent businesses like HSBC being impersonated by scammers. Too late for those already deeply out of pocket, like Sunny.
Clearly, they're not doing enough.
That report from Emily Lawrence. Research out this morning suggests that the superannuation of one in seven Australian women is being eroded as they transition through menopause. The study warns that women who take time off or even retire as they go through menopause could lose as much as $60,000 from their retirement nest egg. Here's the ABC senior business correspondent Peter Ryan.
Kerry McNamee is a human resources specialist. At the age of 37, at the peak of her career, she had some life-changing news.
I had both of my ovaries removed, which then sent me into surgically induced menopause. And then literally kind of within a day or so, the symptoms I started experiencing were intense, ranged from things like migraines, night sweats, joint pain, muscle pain, so many different things.
Over a rapid period, Kerry's mental health went downhill, often getting only 2 hours sleep a night. Eventually, menopause became too much and she paid a big price in lost superannuation.
Obviously, there's only a certain amount of sick leave that you get, and then that moves into unpaid leave, which then obviously affects your superannuation. The support wasn't great from the organisation I was working with, and ultimately led to me leaving that company. So then I was obviously out of work, which then, of course, has a direct impact on superannuation.
Kerry McNamee is now an advocate for Menopause Friendly, working to raise menopause awareness in the workplace. Research by the Association of Superannuation Funds of Australia mirrors her story and shows women transitioning through menopause lose an estimated $60,000 in retirement savings when they cut back on work or retire early. Mary Delahunty is ASFA's chief executive.
160,000 women will enter into a time of menopause every year. We know that some of those women will take time out of the workforce because of the symptoms that they are experiencing.
If 160,000 women a year enter menopause, how many would go on leave or consider going on leave?
The figures would suggest that for a cohort of Australian women who start menopause each year, around 20,000 of them will at some point switch from full-time work to part-time work, and around 10,000 will leave the workforce and around 4,000 will retire early.
What about stress and mental well-being for women who can't stop work or can't retire?
Can you imagine trying to go through your normal working life with severe and debilitating symptoms of menopause? It's astounding, really.
A Senate inquiry is looking at menopause and the impacts on women's careers, mental health and earlier retirement that erode superannuation for women and widen the gender pay gap. One question now is whether plans to top up super for paid parental leave should also be considered for women transitioning through menopause.
Peter Ryan, and that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sally Sara.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. When Donald Trump left the White House in January 2021, it surely wasn't in many people's minds that he could be back. But here we are. Today, the Trump versus Biden rematch for the US presidency that many Americans don't want. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.